Working man. I like it. Call the meeting to order. Good morning. This is State Government's Finance Committee meeting for Tuesday, January 25th, 2011. We now have a quorum. Would someone move the minutes from our meeting of January 20th?
Mr. Chairman, I move the minutes.
Representative Murray? Any additions or corrections to those minutes?
I know.
If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Today we're continuing to get information, an overview of the Office and Department of Management and Budget. Commissioner Showalter is with us today. Welcome back, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter. I am Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Happy to present to you an overview of our agency. I know you've spoken with myself and a number of members of our team already, particularly in the labor relations area. So we'll probably go a little lighter, a lot lighter on that area, and try to give you a flavor for some of the other activities that are in the department. This presentation is substantially the same as what we presented to the Senate just a week or so ago. And it's, I think, a really useful way to help identify some of the key activities and key personnel who are in the department so that you can get an understanding of who to contact, who to talk to throughout session as some of these issues arise. Also, hopefully, it'll spur some of the discussion of reform and government change that you're already undertaking in some of your initial meetings so that you can also understand some of the things that have been going on within our department already in previous years. If you look at the first slide, you see our mission statement, which is pretty simple. To increase state government's capacity to manage and utilize financial, human, information, and analytical resources to ensure exceptional service and value for Minnesota's citizens. I want to make sure everyone's got the slideshow. Okay, good.
Everyone have that handout?
Very good. The whole reason for our agency should be to help look at what resources we have, how to make them work better, and really to point towards, improving government's capacity. Sometimes we talk about our agency as being former finance, sort of bean counters, or former human employee relations, you know, all about people and sort of forms. And it's like, no, I think both organizations were about a lot more than I think is commonly perceived. And putting them together hopefully puts a more of a focus on how do we manage our resources, all types of resources, to get something better. On the next slide, you just see a brief history of the department. It's actually a relatively new department because these two pieces, finance and employee relations, were merged on July 1, 2008. There are very few other states that have tried this. To our knowledge, I think Delaware and Maryland are the only other states that have merged a sort of the financial accounting function along with the human resources function. Shortly after that merger, the governor also added in the consulting arm of state government, management analysis and development from the Department of Administration. So we actually have parts of three departments that are all represented within MMB. The notion, again, is to help provide notions of strategies, information, as well as the data for those decisions all in one particular agency. You'll see on the next slide just a few numbers, unusually few numbers in a presentation that I'll be delivering. But a few numbers here that show what kind of employee level as well as spending are present within our department. You'll see that about 255 FTEs, full-time equivalents, are working at Minnesota Management and Budget, with another 62 who are currently working as part of the SWIFT project. We'll talk about that a lot more, but obviously, just by the number of people that are working on that project, is a substantial effort to change and rework some of the core infrastructure, some of the core IT functionality of the state. The overall department budget, in the grand scheme of things, is a relatively small part of the state budget. You see about $21 million in general fund spending. There is a substantial additional activity within the department known as the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which basically takes in premiums from employees and other people throughout the state, uses those to pay for the health insurance. And so while that's a largely, almost entirely a pass-through activity, it does touch a lot of dollars. And you'll see that is about $773 million in the other funds. That's why that figure looks so very, very large. In terms of value and what you get for this agency and in these services, you need to consider that this is part of the central coordinating function of the state. While there are accounting or financial resources and budgeting people in all state agencies, same for human resources people, really what this is trying to do is knit those resources together to make sure that they work effectively together. That there are many issues that any given agency isn't going to be able to answer or doesn't, shouldn't really, frankly, address because it's going to set statewide policy. That is what you get out of these areas. The accounting services, with about 44 people in it, is really the backbone for making sure that the accounting process works, that we have procedures in place, that we have a system that works on a daily basis. Budget services, you've talked with them already, and you'll continue to talk with them as we put together the governor's budget, and also help to respond to questions of information and context throughout the biennial budget process. We can keep on going through. I just want to also note that information systems is one of the major areas of the department. Even though I talk about finance or I talk about human resources or other functions, really the core, one of the core activities is really gathering the data, making sure that we've got the IT functionality to help all the agencies work most effectively. Some states are finally getting onto the bandwagon of having centralized state services. Minnesota's been at least part of the way down that road for quite a while, in making sure that our statewide systems serve all agencies, or at least nearly all agencies. Some states have multiple accounting systems. That's certainly not the way Minnesota has gone. That consolidation of services, along with just, I'd say, a very rigorous management approach, has allowed the agency to stay fairly small. If you look at the total amount of spending that the two agencies, Dewar and Finance, have had over the last decade, you'll see that there's about a 35% decrease in total state spending during that period of time, so that the general fund is really paying for less and less of those central services. Also over that time, we have about 61 fewer FTE. So I know that one of the themes that you will be looking at is using technology, trying to shrink the size of government. I understand that. I support that. I just hope you also understand the context of the department that's coming before you, that has been part of our legacy. There's a number of different components to the department on the next slide. You'll meet many of the individuals listed on this, entitled Components of MMB. Kristen Hansen is a not yet state employee, but she's on the slide. She will be starting on January 31. She'll be taking over for Kathy Cardell, who might be familiar to some of you, as the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management and Treasury. As such, she'll be a key contact for the rating agencies and a key contact for the capital investment committees here in the legislature, as she helps to manage and guide our debt management and treasury operations for the state. In economic analysis, Dr. Tom Stinson, quite well known as our state economist, longtime leader in assessing the economy, its impacts on revenues, and really sets the baseline for all of our economic forecasts.
Commissioner Representative Murphy had a question.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you give us a little more background on these new people to your department? Where did they come from?
The Assistant Commissioner, Chris Hansen? Certainly. Mr. Chair. Representative Kristen Hansen is currently a senior vice president at Ehlers, a financial advisor for school districts and other public entities. She's been there for, I believe, around 13 years. in that capacity, really helps work through the kinds of issues she's going to help work the state, assess the need for debt, the kinds of structures that are necessary, as well as how to market it. She, I think, brings a really wonderful set of experiences from there, and fortunately also has some exposure to the legislature. So previous experiences also included some brief legislative work and some brief sort of, I think, lobbying kind of public sector work as well. So I think she brings a really unique set of experiences to the job, and we're quite happy to have her.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Continuing on, Information Systems, our Chief Information Officer, Steve Jorgensen. He is not here today, but he is a longtime state employee and the leader of all of our Information Systems activities. State Accounting Services Assistant Commissioner Lori Moe is here. She's one of the leaders on the SWIFT project and can also talk to you extensively about our statewide accounting services. Assistant Commissioner Kristen Dibdahl is also here. She's our State Budget Director. As such, works with through the budget process, as well as trying to help overall some of the decision-making processes. In Labor Relations, Assistant Commissioner Barb Holmes, you've met before, responsible for negotiating state contracts and state arbitrations. And Assistant Commissioner Judy Plant is here. She's responsible for human resources and as well as employee insurance. Nathan Morocco from that program is also present. I know there were some particular questions you wanted to address in those areas, and we'll get to those later in the presentation. So I am going to just continue for just after the question. Yes.
Just Representative one more Murphy. Short one,
sure.
Commissioner. So who does what planning used to do?
Commissioner?
Is that an administration?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is an administration. There's not a lot left of what was planning. But that function, when planning was eliminated, was rolled into the Department of Administration.
And in the Department of Administration, what kind of heading is that under?
Commissioner?
Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
I am going to continue then, Mr. Chair, on a few more slides. As you may know, I was deputy commissioner before being named commissioner, and so as deputy commissioner, I was responsible for a portion of these areas. Since I haven't on my checklist named a deputy commissioner yet, one of the penalties is I have to keep on delivering these slides. So I will continue and do that. Internal controls. It is a key emphasis. 2 years ago, the governor had an initiative to look at how to strengthen the internal controls of the state. It's not a unique a question for the state. It is really something that large organizations worldwide struggle with, how to take the environment, the culture, the practices, the business processes, and add them all together to make sure that the money goes to things and activities that you want them to go to, that you minimize the chance of fraud, you minimize the risk of bad things happening or business disruptions. So internal controls is a very useful unit, a very important initiative for us. Had six people working on sort of the accounting, financial side, another two people in the treasury unit to help oversee some of the things that were going on in our debt issuances. On the next slide, you'll just see some of the activities that we have started to get into. That includes, right off the bat, helping to guide our use of the stimulus funds. When the federal government gave us roughly $5 billion, they didn't give it to us without strings attached. They, in fact, sent a whole flood of auditors and IGs along with it. And one of the things we did on the very front end was to make sure that our process was set up so that we would be ready for them, that we had some of the controls in place and that agencies knew how to handle these additional federal funds. I think that was a very successful effort. Good. In addition, things that are already in progress and continuing to be in progress, the internal control framework, one of the things that we handed off between administrations, sort of an assessment of what's going on in an agency, what are the elements that are successful, what are the real things that aren't going so well, and provide a tool for agency management to continually check on the culture, the communications, the development, the training that might be necessary within the department. Agency site visits, our team has been out and about with agencies on a constant basis, helping set up or bolster the internal auditing functions that are already there. they also provide a concrete way to find follow-up on OLA audits. I know that's not necessarily completely the jurisdiction of this committee, but just so you know the audits are always sort of the last end of finding something that's wrong. You get that audit a year or more after the fact. What this will do is help to make sure that we roll up that information and in a very concrete way ensure that some of the corrective actions are taken, that they stick, and that we have a way to track sort of what are the more severe things to make sure that agency management track those things very closely.
Commissioner, in terms of the follow-up and control function that's needed for all the stimulus funds, how far along are we, or when would we expect to be able to wrap up all of what we need to do in following up on those funds?
Mr. Chair, the stimulus funds are a one-time set of funds that I'm not sure that any new funds are really at this point likely to come through. However, the obligation, the federal process, basically sometimes they're authorized, but they're not necessarily obligated or encumbered, so that the state will still be receiving and spending some of those stimulus funds throughout this fiscal year, and I would expect even into parts of the next fiscal year. We do have reporting requirements that will extend beyond this fiscal year, but not, I think it's like another half year into fiscal year 12. The inspector generals and the follow-up and the auditing process, I have no idea how long that will take, simply because that always lags behind the activities by some period of time. We're really now getting into that first wave of reviews from our federal counterparts.
So at this point, you can't really put any kind of date on when a final report would be possible relative to all of the federal funds that have come in?
Mr. Chair, I can talk with our RIT more just to see if there's a logical breakpoint. I know that some of these funds will continue to be going out or sort of final reconciliation for quite a period of time. I can tell you that at this point, we have a good idea of what's expected. And so, depending on what you want in that final report or assessment of how much money we got or where it's supposed to go, there shouldn't be that much change going on at this point.
And one follow-up question. Have you had to hire additional staff along the way to manage all of this control?
Mr. Chair, yes. In addition to the internal controls initiative that I've been describing, we received an appropriation for the 10 and 11 biennium to hire additional state staff and get some IT resources in order to track and report these funds. When we first started up this effort, there was uncertainty is the mildest word I can put behind what kind of reporting and tracking functionality we're going to be expected from the federal government. We have several people who are working on that, help fulfill our quarterly reporting responsibilities, and make sure that some of the follow-up work is done. Those positions are all and temporary, so they are not funded into the base looking at 12 and 13.
Thank you.
One last thing on internal controls, just in case you want a sort of a daily reminder or a monthly reminder, some of the questions and issues around internal control is we have a bulletin that goes out to state employees. And so if you're at all interested in that, just let me know. We would be happy to add you up to that distribution list. Code of conduct on the next page is also one of the topics that internal controls addresses. Sometimes we get that question, well, Sarbanes-Oxley, we heard about that and all the impact that it had on the private sector. Why isn't there a parallel for the public sector? Well, there is. And internal controls is part of that process to make sure that we've got a demonstrated and time-tested approach to dealing with code of conduct and other kinds of internal control operations. Just to give you, again, a kind of idea of some of the things that are going on, for this code of conduct, about 8,900 state employees were trained just recently by December 31st. So we're trying to make sure that we've got that outreach function going across the state. The next page is Treasury. This is part of Assistant Commissioner Kristen Hansen's portfolio when she comes in, and really it is a very large operation. It's almost like a state bank. All of the cash coming in and out of the state accounts is handled in one way or another through the Treasury and our banking partners. Average amount, cash invested is $485 million, and that's on a daily basis. Over 650 bank accounts. I know I have trouble with my personal bank account. I'm glad I'm not responsible directly for this portion of it. And in addition, just all the warrants that are going in and out, including paychecks. Debt management is the other part of this portfolio. You'll see some additional statistics here about just the kinds of authorizations that we have outstanding, the bond portfolio that we're managing, and try to make sure that we minimize interest costs for the state. We continue a very conservative practice of trying to pay down that debt as fast as possible so that we don't really have surprises or leverage ourselves going out into the future. There were some changes in our debt guidelines just in the last couple of years. We can certainly talk about that more in the future. But again, overall, we try to make sure that the investors know that we are a well-managed state, that we have conservative debt practices, and really try to make sure that the legislature has an understanding of the tools that are available to it through the debt process. In economic analysis, this is Tom Stinson's unit. Major products, really, are the revenue forecast, along with the economic updates that go with it each quarter. That provides the benchmark for all of us to understand what's going on in the economy, the impact on our revenue stream, and ultimately, when you put that together with the spending, what's happening to the state budget picture. In his presentations internally, gives a couple points. Just for background, I included them in this slide. One is that the forecast is a revenue forecast. No, that's a myth. The forecast is actually a revenue and a spending forecast. There's always changes on both pieces of it. And if you just see one bit of information, like revenue changes, you really still don't know what's going on because there could be significant issues on the expenditure side. Two, that they only count money in the bank. No. The forecast really is a projection of what's going on based upon what's happened already. So depending on what point in time you are looking at, it may reflect money in the bank, but more often when we're talking about budgets, we're talking about prospective estimates of what's going on in the economy. Three, the economy is doing well, so the forecast will be up, or the converse, the economy is not doing so well, so the forecast will be down. Now, because we factor that into the forecast, so really it is, again, a projection, and the question is whether we're beating expectations or going worse than expectations. That's always the question that we answer in the change to the forecast. And finally, those guys are always conservative. They're economists. They must be conservative. No, they're trying to give you the best set of information. Yeah, there's going to be risk around it, and they're not trying to shave revenue estimates just to make sure that they're always doing better than forecast. I think if you look at the track record for the forecast, you'll see that sometimes we're doing better than forecast, sometimes we're doing worse than forecast. That's, in fact, exactly where we should be. Knowing that there's other financial tools, whether they're the reserve policy, the appropriations approach, the how we structure accounts, all of those things enter into our total financial management structure, and it's not just a matter of the estimates and what those carry. Information systems on the next page. Goes into the other very large unit within our department. You'll see some of the areas that includes technical support, sort of the desktop support and networks that we run, business intelligence and agency applications. With all of the different activities that are in our department, we also have smaller applications, not the statewide applications, but smaller applications. This unit helps build those, maintain those, as well as find ways to get information out of the warehouse. So some of those custom requests of information that you may ask for oftentimes will come out of this unit. Benefits and payroll, that's really the state HR and management tool. It provides all the information data on employees, wages, taxes, all of those things go through the system. They just are, I think, producing the W-2s right now. Information access, budget information, and the data warehouse. Again, trying to look at all of the data information sources and some of the systems that we use to get that information out and try to manage with it. And finally, the accounting and procurement system. MAPS is our legacy system. It's been with us, I believe, since 94, 95. We are in the process of replacing it. It's a substantial project, and we're going to get into that more in just a minute. The bottom line here is that there's substantial information technology activities going on, and it is really part of the core of our activity. You know, if we don't have the data, it's hard to make good decisions, and that data is what we use to go forward. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I'm going to have Lori Moe, Assistant Commissioner for Accounting Services, come on down and join me for financial reporting.
Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, in your information systems, do you also have track there your unemployment of your state employees and things like that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, is do we track state unemployment? That's out of deed. The unemployment statistics are managed out of that area. We do manage the personnel files basically for state employees. So like if we have a state employee and they are laid off for whatever reason, that transaction is handled out of Semaphore. But the statewide labor force data is not handled within our department.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Showalter, then the unemployment status of the state as far as overall status would not be through this but through deed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's right.
Representative Slava.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Showalter, yesterday on the news I heard there was a school district that went paperless, and they said it just saved them millions and millions of dollars. And I know we still get a paper copy of our paychecks. Is the state going paperless, or is it going to go paperless?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. Actually, that's one of the things we have been moving towards now. I'm trying to think of exactly the legislative checks. Are they? Do we have those?
Ms. Moe?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Lori Moe. The state Semaphore system has made a great deal of progress towards being paperless. More than 99.5% of our payments are made by direct deposit. We also, for several years, have delivered all of our pay stub information electronically. Okay. And we also, for example, do as many of our W-2s electronically as possible. Those were delivered, the electronic versions of W-2s, for example, have been available to our employees for a couple of weeks now. The few remaining paper ones that are still printed are being printed today. Thank you.
Ms. Moe, Representative Murray?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Showalter, on the Treasury slide there, it shows the amount of debt that we currently have outstanding. With interest rates at historic lows, have we been refinancing some of this debt? And if so, are we able to continue doing that? And what kind of savings can we expect to the state in doing so?
Excellent.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. I can certainly follow up with some more of the statistics, but yes, the interest rate environment gave us an opportunity, a very unique opportunity, to refund some of our existing debt. When we issue debt, there's sort of a window that we have to, when we can refund it. So you can't refund it instantly, you can't refund it a year afterwards, but after it's matured for a number of years, you do have the opportunity to refund it, basically to call those bonds in. And we did, don't quote me on this, but I'm thinking it was around $800 million of refunding activity just this fall. That led to significant savings, interest savings for the state, and led to, in fact, a premium payment that came into the state for some of those interest savings that's reflected in the forecast. If you look at some of the significant swings in the November forecast, you'll note that debt service went down a bunch. It's largely because of the refunding activity that we did this fall.
Thank you. Ms. Moe.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have responsibility for the Accounting Services Division, and that's comprised of three groups and approximately 44 full-time equivalent employees. The first area is the financial reporting area with responsibility for general accounting, and statewide financial reporting. This is the group that maintains the statewide accounting system, performs various statewide reconciliations to maintain the integrity of the accounting system, and has responsibility for statewide financial reporting. One of the biggest products that you may be familiar with is what we call our CAFR, or our Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. This is the audited financial statements prepared according to generally accepted accounting principles, the financial statements that are audited by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the statements that are used by our bond rating agencies and other users to evaluate the state's financial condition. We also have number of responsibilities for compliance with federal reporting requirements, which includes audit of all federally assisted programs, what we call the single audit. That work is also done by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We file the statewide indirect cost allocation plan, comply with cash management requirements, and also do reporting on follow-up for audit findings impacting federal programs. The financial reporting group also works closely with the agency support area. This is a accounting support group that provides a wide range of services to agencies. We provide basic transaction support for some of the smallest agencies, and at the other end of the spectrum, complex policy interpretation for some of the larger agencies that have their own in-house accounting staff but look to us for the statewide policies and procedures. We also provide training on policies, on procedures, and on operation of and use of the statewide accounting system. The file maintenance and system compliance group in this area has more of an operations focus. This is the group that makes sure that new vendors get set up so that they can be paid on a timely basis, that payments are made on schedule, that we're in compliance with both state and federal tax reporting requirements, and maintain the vendor file for all of the payments from suppliers to cities, counties, school districts, grant recipients. All of those payments are made out of this central group. And to the earlier question regarding the move towards paperless operations, we have been for a number of years been converting payments in this area to electronic payments as well. We still have a fair number of paper warrants that are issued. Those are primarily for the low volume kind of payments, but by far in terms of dollar amounts, the vast majority of the payments are made by electronic funds transfer rather than paper warrants. The third area in accounting services is the statewide payroll services group, and this is the central payroll processing for all state agencies that use what we call the Semaphore system. Semaphore is the central payroll, HR, and benefits administration administrative system that we operate at MMV, and in my area falls the payroll processing. We have an operations group which does make sure that time reporting is processed on schedule, payroll calculations, tax computations, deduction processing, preparation of those direct deposit files are all completed on schedule. There's also a training and communications group that provides, again, the statewide policy and procedure, statewide direction to the user agencies. We have a system support group that, along with our IT partners, monitors the system performances and manages system updates and fixes provided by the vendor. And then finally, we have a control function that ensures compliance with all of the many tax and other regulatory requirements. That is the permanent divisions in accounting services. I'm happy to answer questions, or I will turn this over to Kristen Dibdahl to cover the budget division.
Could you reiterate, we talked about this here earlier, but could you reiterate sort of the status of the movement to the SWIFT system and whether or not there are important issues that we're being confronted with regard to that conversion?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members, I was here a couple of weeks ago and talked with you regarding what we call the SWIFT project. This is the project that is replacing the statewide accounting and procurement system. The project has been a long-term project that began with planning about 5 years ago. The implementation process is currently underway. We have a scheduled go-live date of July 1, 2011, which is the end of a two-year implementation period. As I talked with you at my previous visit, it's a very large, very complex project. We have been monitoring progress closely. We have made a number of adjustments to the course of the project along the way, and we are continuing to do so. We expect to go live on July 1 with our core functionality. We have made adjustments to the project in a couple of areas primarily. One area is the what's called the EPM module. This is the module that we've, the software that we purchased to replace our current data warehouse operation. And we have replanned the rollout of that functionality. We, in the November, December timeframe, we met with agencies and prioritized that work and modified the rollout of that product to coincide with the agency priorities. And the first phase now is scheduled for rollout at the end of January. We also have done some replanning primarily around some of the procurement enhancements and also in the area of inventory and cost allocation modules, which is new functionality for the system. In the area of inventory and cost allocation, we now expect to do a rollout on July 1 to a pilot group of agencies. And for the procurement functionality, while we expect the core functionality to be live on July 1, there will be some elements that will be implemented after July 1.
If things don't go according to your hopes and plans at this point, what then would happen if you're not able to go live on July 1? If something should happen that would delay that, what would happen then?
Mr. Chairman, members, when we were planning this project originally, we spent a lot of time analyzing the options for conversion and made gave a lot of consideration to whether we should plan a conversion which occurs at the end of a fiscal year and the end of a biennium, or whether we would do a mid-year kind of conversion. One of the considerations we gave in making that decision was the understanding that while an end-of-year and end-of-biennium conversion is more straightforward, it also very much limits your options because you only have that opportunity annually. And so we have been proceeding with a plan for end-of-year conversion and still expect to do that. But to change gears and move to a mid-year conversion would be a considerable effort.
So you're completely confident then that you're going to be able to convert on July 1. Is that the way I understand what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, the analysis that we have done recently in looking at the project status indicates that we will be able to deliver the existing functionality on July 1, in addition to a number of the enhancements.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your comment about the data warehouse being in phase two triggered a recollection. Representative Winkler had a provision in our bill last year that required a citizen portal type of access to state transaction data. And I'm curious, I guess maybe question one is, I'm assuming the new system would have kind of a greater capability in that regard for citizens to really look at core finance data. So if you could say yes or no to that. And then what would be the timing on the delivery of a citizen portal type access in the new system?
Ms. Moll?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, the citizens portal was not a requirement in our original RFP because our original RFP was published before that discussion during the 09 session. But following passage of that requirement, we did include that in our contract negotiations, and so the requirements that were put in statute in 09 were included in our contract, and there has been no discussion that cannot be met as provided in the contract. So I'm expecting delivery of that for the July 1 of 11. But keeping in mind that, no, in fact, I'm just thinking back to the statute. We do have provisions to convert 2 years of history, as was provided in the statute. So there will be some historical data available even on the initial day of operation.
Thank you. Ms. Dibdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kristen Dibdahl, State Budget Director. I manage the budget division within MMB, and that's a group of around 25 analysts and managers, nonpartisan budget analysts and managers. And simply put, our charge is really to provide objective analysis and context for decision makers. And that ranges from purely financial issues to programmatic issues to budget issues. So in terms of our work, we do, you're probably very familiar that we're heavily engaged in coordinating the governor's operating and capital budget process. But we also assist legislative committees in deliberations and in working with fiscal analysts on particular issues. And then another large part of our work is really providing technical assistance and oversight to agencies, and that happens throughout the year. We are organized loosely into two different categories. I would say the budget service teams, and they're organized around policy and budget areas, and so you're probably familiar with the term executive budget officer. Those are budget analysts that have particular areas of expertise, and Catherine Barando, I don't see her here today, but she is our budget officer that that looks at state government issues, so she will be working with this committee. And then we have a group of people that work on budget operations, and you heard from one of them a couple weeks ago when we talked about the budget system, but the operations folks are really the ones that work on the budget system itself, the budget process, the fiscal note system and the fiscal note process, and those types of operational activities. Our key deliverables really in the budget division center around, as I mentioned before, development of the governor's biennial budget, supplemental budget, operating budget, and then capital budgets. We're also very involved in the forecast process, and so for the November and February forecasts, we are working very closely with agencies. For example, Department of Human Services, Department of Education, in understanding the expenditure side of the forecast. And then we help to look at those assumptions that are being made as part of those forecasts, you know, vet those assumptions, and then help to roll in combination with the state economist, roll up the numbers into a macro picture that provides the basis for decision-making moving forward in the session.
Excuse me, Representative Banyan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you satisfy a curiosity for me, Ms. Dibdahl? This is. I don't have any agenda with this. I get asked this question frequently as an economist myself. We're here waiting to do the budget, and the budget information, the forecast information, doesn't come out till the first week of March. And people always ask me, why does it not come till March? Why don't we get it sooner? Is there a good, simple answer that I could give people?
Ms. Dibdahl?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, are you talking about the actual budget? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, part of the reason, especially this year, is obviously because of the election and the transition. So normally the governor would submit the budget in January. There are some reasons that I can't fully explain it in terms of timing of the economic forecast, but the November economic forecast really provides the basis upon which to make some budget decisions, and so the January timeline is really kind of needed to get that budget put together. Now, this year is an exception where we have transition, and we need a little extra time to get it done.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dibdahl, so if you got the information from Global Insights a little sooner in a year where we don't have the governor changing, would it be possible to get this done sooner?
Ms. Dibdahl?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would need to work with Tom Stinson to understand why it is that the November date is a special date, and I think there is a reason for it, but I'm not going to be articulate with that right now.
Fine. Thank you. I'll ask Mr. Stinson when I next see him.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Okay. and I think I was just talking about some of our major deliverables. One of the things that kind of gets glossed over sometimes is that once the session is over and the appropriation bills are set, our work really begins to implement the budget. So our analysts are going back and working with agencies and looking at all of the line items, all of the spending, and making sure that there's an appropriate link between the budget work and the budget bills and the accounting system, and making sure that agencies are spending how the legislature and the governor intended the money be spent. So that's a considerable amount of work for our division in the summer. And then I would just say lastly, our division is in a very unique position, I guess, to look across, because we have individuals that specialize in different budget areas, and then we have individuals that are looking at the macro picture. We're in a very unique position in our division to look across state government programs and provide policymakers like yourselves with more statewide budget information, trends, heads up on issues, or other opportunities within state government.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Budget Director. I have a question about fiscal notes. You know, we have a new and different administration, so things probably aren't going to be how they were last time, but their fiscal notes were handled differently by every single department, and how they were, some didn't take very long, Department of Education, some took forever, Department of Human Services. Some were highly political, some were not political, in terms of what they added and what they didn't. Is there going to be more consistent policies, or do you see any changes in fiscal notes, or has there been discussion of that? And also the SWIFT system was supposed to tie into fiscal notes, right?
Ms. Dibdahl?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I know that there's been a lot of discussion about the fiscal note process, and in fact, I would probably refer you to a study that was just put out. I don't know if you're aware, there was a study commissioned by the last legislature to take a look at the fiscal note process specifically for human services, because that's an area where we had, I would say, the most problems, at least from a timing perspective. And so they really looked at it. The funding was appropriated to MMB, or to the budget division, and we contracted with Management Analysis Division, because obviously we work on fiscal notes, so we didn't want to be studying it ourselves, and really took a very comprehensive approach to look at MMB, the agency process, the process within the agency, and then as well, because it's a shared process with the legislature, the legislative side of things. And I think they came out with some pretty good recommendations. In the human services area, a lot of the issues relate to the complexity, frankly, of those bills. And the fact that a lot of technical assistance has to happen on the front end in order to get a bill to the place where the department feels like it can really score it from a financial perspective. You also referenced the kind of politicizing or not politicizing. Our division really, the best we can, I mean, the fiscal note area is very isolated in terms of how the information flows up to, say, the commissioner or whatever. We really are relying on our nonpartisan analysts to review the work of the department and try to put that objective lens on the fiscal note. Now, I understand that a lot of times the answer coming out of the fiscal note process is not necessarily consistent with what decision makers want to see. And so I do think that there's opportunity for more, a little bit more back and forth, or at least MMB can be, I think, helpful in facilitating conversations between the agency and legislators to really understand the assumptions better.
Representative Flowers.
Chair, just a quick follow-up. I think it's going to be particularly important because it's the legislature's flipped now. Obviously, mm-hmm. with the Democratic administration and the Republicans introducing and controlling most of the bills. I mean, we had the opposite, and so they were doing fiscal notes on our bills, and then the administration was doing them. So that causes a lot of tension, depending on how they're interpreting. And I think better communication would have helped a lot, because sometimes the costs came out to be gigantic when our idea was really this big. And sometimes that's a way of kiboshing a bill, you know?
Right.
Put the cost way up there. I hope to all of us that process is more clear and more less politicized this year.
Ms. Dibdahl, we're going to need to have you wrap up so we can get to the remaining items on our agenda.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're in luck. I'm done.
Okay. Good timing, huh? Thank you, Ms. Dibdahl.
Thank you.
Ms. Plant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Plant. I am Assistant Commissioner for Human Resources and Employee Insurance. I'm going to just go through the overview of the areas that I have and then introduce Mr. Morocco, who can answer some questions that were directed to him on the CEGIT program, and then I'll touch on the workforce planning report.
Okay.
In your packet, you have a slide for labor relations. I believe you've had a lengthy presentation from Assistant Commissioner Holmes on that already, and that slide actually replaced the one that I should have for human resource management. So let me regale you for a moment or two about that part of our organization, and then we'll get on to some other topics. Human resource management is the part of our department that does two main functions. The first is that we manage the employee records part of Semaphore. So you heard about the payroll records part, how we make paychecks occur out of that same system. Well, Semaphore keeps the records of hires and promotions and transfers and demotions and whatever else happens in the life of a state employee. So that is one key function. We also have the state's application system. The current system is a Resimex. It's been around for quite some time, and if any of you have tried to apply for a state job, you probably have some of the same concerns about that system that I do, so we're constantly working on that to keep it functional. And we also have a learning management system that is a component part of SWIFT that has come on to allow the training of SWIFT rollout, but ultimately it will serve as a learning management system for all of the executive branch. So the other main function is that we, in that area, develop, oversee, and maintain the human resource policy framework in which state agencies administer their human resources functions. So as Commissioner Showalter was saying, in each of the state agencies, there are some human resource professionals who are carrying out transactional work or making, giving advice to their commissioners on hiring processes and things. We are the ones who pull all that together into a policy that is uniform across this very vast organization. And the framework for that comes from Statute 43A. The main functions there are looking at classification, compensation, selection, and staffing. In classification, some of our key work is in looking at the appropriate level and description of jobs and comparisons with other like jobs or other jobs that require similar skills across agencies. As you can imagine, trying to keep consistency among jobs of equal weight to make sure that they are paid relatively the same across multiple organizations is a bit of a challenge. We do also look at compensation, and we tackle things or try to tackle things that are presented to us, disparities between those jobs, where equal jobs have not been paid equally. We also look at some of the market factors in setting salaries for incoming employees within the established ranges that are set in the labor contracts. So I'll give you an example. In the Department of Public Safety, there are a number of forensic scientists who, no doubt, their jobs are every bit as cool as they look on television in those great glass offices everyone seems to work on. I don't think we have any of those here. But those forensic scientists, for example, we have a compensation issue in that our local government counterparts can pay considerably more. And so we've had to look at the entry-level salary to make sure that we are both attracting people but also able to retain them over time. Because what has been happening is we bring them in, they get a couple years' experience, and they fly off to the counties and make considerably more money, between $10,000 and $20,000 more per year. So that's one of the challenges that we have, is trying to figure out how do we pay adequately to get the right assets available to do the state of Minnesota's work. And that's an ongoing issue. In terms of selection, we set the process and steps for selection to make sure that we are meeting all of the state and federal laws and requirements in that process. And then finally, we do look at ongoing staffing issues between units of government. How do we mobilize people when needed? So now we're back to the slides that you have. And a subset of the HRM budget has been set aside for the function of workforce planning and development. And again, our challenge here is to make sure we have the right people in the right place to do the right work. That includes both basic replacement. If we have staff at a state facility, will we be able to attract and retain the right staff to replace positions as they turn over? We're also helping agencies with a relatively new model for us in terms of workforce planning of identifying pivotal positions. That being, you can have a lot of important people, but the one or two people who really make the place run, to make sure that when those people decide to fly off to another employer or retire, that we have done the right legwork to have a replacement ready for those pivotal positions. As you know, we have a retirement cliff that has just been looming. We've, in an odd way, benefited from the stalled economy in that people haven't jumped ship as quickly as they could have. According to Dr. Gillespie from the State Demographer's Office, there looks to be 1,700 people eligible. Eligible meaning they're in the 61 to 62-year-old category, which is typically the age of retirement for state workers. And we can say more about that when we get to the workforce report. And again, looking at who to recruit and how to recruit, again, having identified pivotal positions, I'll give you another example. In some of our state facilities, the big old buildings that use the big old boilers, we need stationary engineers. And we used to have a pretty steady stream of those coming in, young men who would go off to the Navy and learn that technology and decide to come back to Minnesota, and they were ready-made for that job. The Navy doesn't use that technology anymore. Our system has dried up. And so in the future, finding stationary engineers will be more of an outreach effort to attract that kind of talent than it has been in the past. We also in that area look at workforce diversity and pay equity and the area of training and development. Key here, we emphasize supervisory and managerial core, leadership development, and the Emerging Leaders Institute. Among that cadre of people who are teed up to retire not only in the next few years but over the next, say, five, are a considerable number of our managers and supervisors. And so assuming that some of those will need to be replaced, we need to make sure that we have a workforce that is prepared to step into those leadership roles. So that is one area of emphasis. And with that, let me just do a brief overview of employee insurance, and maybe Nathan, you can join me to answer specific questions. We have two main functions in the employee insurance division. The first is the SEGIP program that Mr. Morocco will address. And that, actually, I'll just skip that slide and let you do the whole thing. The second is the Public Employer Insurance Program, PEEP. That is mandated by the legislature to be available to other independent business units, mainly cities, counties, K-12 districts, and about 23 other. We have one dedicated staff for this. And you can see the stats on your sheet as to who was covered in the fall of 2010. A lot of similar design issues to SEGIP. And I know there's a lot of questions on that, so I'll stop now unless you have questions for me.
Before we move to the SEGIP presentation, what is the relationship of your operation to the House and Senate HR departments? Is there some connection or relationship, or are they essentially independent?
They are essentially independent.
And do we have other independent groups? HR organizations throughout the...
We do for some small entities. I can get you a list. I'm blanking on exactly who. I'm thinking the Office of the Legislative Auditor, obviously. I think some of the constitutional officers. So, but not in terms of state executive branch agencies.
There are no other independent...
Not that I'm aware of.
HR? Right. So essentially you're coordinating or dealing with HR functions for everything except the House and the Senate?
Broadly, yes. And I will double-check and make sure there's no small independent boards or anything that are not under our purview, but I believe that they all are. Metropolitan Council, of course, is a regional government, and they are not under our HR. We also don't do the judicial branch.
Okay, so that's a separate independent yes. Operation as well.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the two programs that Commissioner Plant had referenced, and we received a request for some information. I'm assuming that you all folks have all this have this packet. So I'll just spend a couple minutes going through this, give you a really brief description about how we bargain benefits, a description about the key element of our program, which is the health plan, the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan that you all participate in, and then finally we'll wrap up with the financial aspect of that health plan, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Just as a going to page two, as a quick overview, we serve about 120,000 lives. That's about 50,000 state employees with 70,000 dependents. We spend about $750 million per year on employee benefits for the state of Minnesota. We are the largest employer group in the state. We access about 1,200 clinics through 55 care systems, and we are 90% unionized. Turning to page three are some of the highlights of the CGIP program. The CGIP is an acronym for the State Employee Group Insurance Program. It's important to note that this program is broader than just the executive branch of government. It does include all three branches of government, as well as the MNSCU universities or state college systems, and it also does include some quasi-state agencies like Historical Society and some various boards. Highlights of the program that we have would be your typical medical and dental programs. We also have flexible spending accounts, health reimbursement arrangements. We have long-term and short-term disability, long-term care, life insurance, very typical components of an employer-based program. We also have specific features of our program, which include employee assistance program, health assessments, medical therapy management. We'll talk more specifics about some of these programs further in the presentation. Couple of key components at a high level financially. We've had 3 years of zeros in zero premium. That was in 2006, 2010, and 2011. And again, on the financial section, I'll talk a little bit about how we were able to achieve those zeros. We won an Innovations in State Government Award for the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan. This isn't necessarily intended to be an award for health programs. It's really intended to be about any area of state government that has demonstrated innovation. And that's a piece that we're very proud of. That's a national award that we won. We're members of multiple purchasing groups, and we are the first and only public member to launch a pay-for-performance program known as Bridges to Excellence in the community, where we pool our resources with other organizations like Best Buy, Target, 3M, and Medtronic to reward doctors who really demonstrate high performance in the marketplace. And again, we can talk more about those kinds of programs if you're interested. We're also involved in a depression program in this community known as Diamond. So let me just talk real briefly about the how we come about to design our program. Back in the 80s, when we were negotiating with the AFSCME group, we had reached a final settlement, and the other bargaining units wanted something different. And really, from a management perspective, there was a lot of efficiencies to be gained by having a single or simplified plan design system. That was really the catalyst to the creation of the Joint Labor Management Committee on Health Plans. This is a committee that we use as management to talk with the unions about the things that we're interested in health, in the health plan, health design, health improvement, and it's a way for the unions to provide feedback to us. This is really where we accomplish through bargaining the plan design, and then we coordinate that with Assistant Commissioner Holmes when we settle the broader contracts with the union members. So going to page five, the membership then would include management, would include union representatives, and we also bring in many subject matter experts. Oftentimes we'll bring in medical directors from the health plans or from provider groups to help us work through health and health promotion activities. And it really, again, is a collaboration to talk about insurance trends. So the advantages then go into slide six. Obviously, we have one set of system rules. We have one set of premiums, and we really minimize issues related to region, the various business units, issues related to employees who may be working in multiple jobs throughout the state, any adverse selection that might occur. If you have multiple programs, you may have employees selecting against certain programs, leading to issues there. And really, from an administrative perspective, it really simplifies our operation. We know, whether from governor to groundskeeper to legislators, we're going to know exactly your plan design and your premium setup the moment you contact one of our service center representatives, and that really cuts down on the number of folks that it takes to communicate and administer the benefits for the state. So moving on to page seven, let me just talk briefly about the program and the inception of the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan. That is the program that you all participate in. The health program is really, I think, where we focus most of our activity, as it represents about 85% of the spend of that $750 million that I referenced, and that's really what I'll be focusing on from here on out. Back in the mid to late 90s, we had a different kind of program. It was a managed care competition program, by where we had health plans really making bids by county to offer various programs to our state employees. While that had some success during the 90s, the program did run into problems in the mid to late 90s, by where one of the health plans had bid a little bit too aggressively and probably overreached their liability, essentially leaving them with some serious debt and leaving the state with some debt. So the program realized that it needed to do something. It approached the legislature in the late 90s and said that it wanted to go fully self-insured. That means that it wanted to bear all the risk, and it wanted to manage the program for state employees at 100% level. And so that was really the inception of the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan, and it was through an appropriation from the legislature that allowed this to happen. Really, the first thing that the group did at that time was to take all the claims data that were out there for state employees and analyze what that looked like. And that's what you're seeing on chart 7, actually. This is something, it's actually from 2004. It was a couple years after. But what this is this is a chart showing, on a risk-adjusted basis, the cost for all the clinics that are out there in the state of Minnesota. When I say on a risk-adjusted basis, what I'm saying is that regardless of the member that may walk through the door, the impact that these providers are having on our members are no different, yet on a cost basis, we're seeing a differential of $332 up to $575. That's a difference of about $230 without any difference in outcomes in terms of the services or health benefits to our members. This was really kind of at that time, a very revolutionary idea and really a revolutionary analysis about the differences that occur out there in the marketplace. This is really then the fundamental structure of the Minnesota Advantage Health Plan. When we talk about tiering, what we're talking about is a plan design that creates better transparency for the employees, and through plan design, trying to direct them to more efficient care systems, the Tier 1 and 2 providers, and move them away from the least efficient care systems, those that would be in the third to fourth tier. I think the nice benefits of this program is that while we try to steer members and create transparency, we're ultimately not denying anybody choice. We're keeping every care system within the choice realm for state employees, but we're demonstrating to them that there are differences, there are health benefits to the members by doing that, and there's cost savings to the plan. So let me, if you'll turn to the next page, you can see in a snapshot sort of how we do that. This is an excerpt from the Advantage Health Plan Schedule of Benefits, and you'll see that we have cost level 1, 2, 3, and 4. I'll turn your attention to Schedule B, and you'll see in cost level 1, then for a single employee in cost level 1, their first dollar deductible is $50. In cost level 4, that same deductible is $600. Here's where we start to create the transparency in the program. So again, members can go to whichever clinic that they want, but from a program perspective, there's no difference in outcomes between level 1 and level 4. So really, it's if the members want to pay for that choice, they can do that. But there's no reason that the state should pay for that choice. Again, I would direct your attention to Schedule C, and you'll see that a copay for an office visit will be $17 in cost level 1, and in cost level 4, it would be $37. Again, what we're really emphasizing here is at the point of service, every time a member goes to the clinic, they're being reminded that their choice for that clinic is impacting their cost every time that they go in and see the doctor. So this really is having quite a positive effect on the program in that it's directing more members to the more efficient care systems. We now have roughly 85% of state employees and their members going to a cost level 1 and cost level 2. That means those folks are really receiving optimal care, and we are experiencing optimal cost savings. And for the 15% of our members that choose to go elsewhere, they can pick up some of the additional expenses related to that choice. So this is really the fundamental premise of the Advantage Health Plan. I'd be happy to go into more detail on it, but with time being short, I will move on. The next slide really is demonstrates sort of how we look at our program, how we target various folks, whether they are in the well status, at-risk status, all the way up to catastrophic. Again, in the interest of time, I won't talk about the specific programs that target this various spectrum of health status, but obviously our goal is to keep people at the well and at-risk levels. If possible, if they're at the chronic illness, to keep them there so that they don't progress into further more catastrophic states of managing their illness. And just at a very high level, it's important to understand that really for any typical large employer, 20% of your members are going to be about 77% of your spend. So in terms of where this roughly $600 to $700 million in medical expenses is going, it really is only going to the 22% of our members. The rest of the folks that are relatively healthy or perhaps in an at-risk category, they really are not spending a whole lot in the program. So really our focus from a program perspective, again, is to manage the cost at the high levels and to manage the health at the lower levels. Going to page 10, I'll just give you my brief spiel on prevention versus chronic care. In 2007, the average cost of preventative service was $184 per member. In that same year, the cost of a single hospital stay was $13,000. So really, there's a lot that we can do around preventative services that can go a long way if we can just avoid that one hospital stay. And that's really how we focus our program, again, is to keep people healthy, keep them out of the hospital. I'm going to skip, again, in the interest of time, I'll skip our medical therapy management discussion and head right into slide 12, which is the financials of the medical program. This is a document that we created about 3 years ago. We share this with the labor group. We also share this with the legislature. I meet with Helen Roberts and with Kevin Lundeen, who are your fiscal folks, and we go over the finances of the program at least once a year, oftentimes twice a year, and talk about where the program is going. This is kind of a busy slide, and really most of it is intended to be for internal use, but I'm going to direct you to four key areas that I think you would be interested in so that you can better understand how the program is performing. Let's look at the first top circle, and we're going to look at premium increases. This is on a calendar year basis, so please keep that in mind, that these are not fiscal years, but calendar years, and you'll get a sense of where the premiums have gone. So we've gone from 6.7 to 3.5. We've had two zeros. We're experiencing the final zero now. We're projecting for 2012 an 8%, in 13 a 17%, and in 14 a 7.2%. I'll talk a little bit about how those premiums are achieved and how they interact with our reserves in a moment. But the thing that's important to recognize is that premiums are not an indication of medical trend. A premium trend is not a medical trend. And you'll see that in the second line in the claims paid and incurred. So if we look at moving, let's say, from calendar year 10 to calendar year 11, you'll see that the premium increases are 0%, but you'll see that the cost to the program is actually increasing by $40 million. So it's important, the correlation between the premium and how we're managing our reserves is a key component to driving ultimately what the premium needs are for the program. Let me direct you then to the third portion, which is the interest income. And the piece here that I think is important is that historically we would have been collecting $10 plus million per year in interest on the monies that we are keeping in the program for reserves, and we are now looking more like about $3 million per year. This is important because the interest in the program is money that we direct right back into the program, and therefore those are monies that we don't have to achieve through increased premiums. So to the extent that interest rates continue to be low, it puts more pressure on the premiums for the program. Lastly, then, we'll talk about reserves, and then we can tie that into how that impacts our premiums. So you'll note that at the end of 2010, we were reserved at about 35% of the program. For those folks who are not familiar with benefit programs, the reserves are there to manage any fluctuations that may occur within any given risk pool. Fluctuations might happen as a result of a lot of catastrophic claims. There might be several, perhaps multi-hundred-thousand or multi-million-dollar claims that would be unexpected. It could be because of a flu pandemic, and there are things that you didn't account for when you were forecasting the program. So the reserves are really there to manage the cash flow of the program. Reserves for smaller groups and reserves for fully insured products are going to be somewhere in the 30% range. 30 to 35% is typical for a small group or for a fully insured. That's what the Department of Commerce, if they were to regulate the fully, and they do regulate the fully insured market, they would want those kinds of reserves because a smaller group is going to have a lot more volatility, and certainly if the health plans are going to offer a fully insured product, the Department of Commerce is going to want to ensure that that health plan is solvent. That is their key goal, is to ensure solvency. So we look at our program, and we recognizing that we are a little bit larger than a small group, and looking at our historical trends, working with our actuaries and working with the Department of Commerce, our reserve levels are appropriate at 16.7%. 16.7% is 2 months' worth of claims. So that really is our goal, and that's how we manage the reserves of the program. To the extent that we are over-reserved in the program, we will apply those dollars back into the premiums, okay? Essentially keeping the premiums artificially low by subsidizing the premiums through our reserves. And to the extent that we are under-reserved on that 16.7, we will then artificially increase the premiums in order to bring the reserves back up to 16.7. So in the most recent example, during the bargaining process, we had projected in 2011 a 6.7% increase. That is what we thought we were going to need 2 years ago when we were bargaining the benefits. Okay, as 2011 came closer and closer, and we were able to analyze actual experience in the program, we recognized that we didn't need that 6.7. The prior years had built the reserves higher than we wanted, and so we moved the premiums down to 0% in an effort to bring those reserves back in line to that 16.7. So you'll see that the impact that has then in 2011 is that we're bringing the reserves down to 25%. Obviously, 16.7 is lower than that 25%. So we are then going to apply those additional monies into 2012 so that by the end of 2012, we are at the 16.7 reserve levels. So that is how the program appears to have 0% premium increases, yet still experiences some modest medical trend. And the interaction or the interplay between the reserves and the premiums that we charge to employees and to agencies. So you'll see then that starting in 2012, the reserves are at the appropriate 16.7%. The impact that has is that obviously we're taking one-time money and we're putting it into a program that is growing, the expenses are growing. And the impact that does have is once those one-time monies are gone from the reserves, then there's more, then the premiums take on more of the responsibility for covering the cost of the program. And that's why you will then see a jump in 2013 of 17%. So while the 17% is high, it's on top of a couple zeros prior to that. In the end, it really is the same, if you were to look at any 2 or 4 year period of time, it really is spending the same amount of money in the program. It's really a matter of whether or not you spend the money in the current calendar year, current fiscal year, or whether some of that money is being shared across fiscal years. But again, because we're taking the reserves and directing them back to the program, the net cost or net savings to the state is really the same either way. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. I just did a quick calculation on the claims paid, and it looks like actual and forecasted increases in claims paid is around 7%. And so I'm wondering why the 17% premium increase forecasted out in 2013 when that doesn't seem to jive with the actual claims experience.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, what we're really, let's perhaps look at it this way. The cost of the plan is in 2010 is $561 million. The cost in 2013 is $700 million. The premium difference that's needed there is $150 million. And so when you're jumping from a revenue stream that's largely flat, and then needing to make up the $150 million, that's where the one-time funds on the reserves are artificially keeping the premiums down while the cost of the program goes up. And so now the premiums are not jumping up $40 million from one year to the next. They're jumping up $100 to $150 million over a two-year period of time. That's what leads to that cliff effect in the program.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what drives the decision making on the levels of reserves? And I don't know the health insurance industry well enough to know whether those reserves are, you know, typical in the private sector, or are these policy decisions that drive us in one direction or another, or is there some kind of industry standard that, you know, pushes these numbers up and down this way?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't believe that there's a hard and fast rule. It's been the internal policy of the agency to set it at 16.7, being guided by the regulators, the Department of Commerce. Certainly there are other states that run zero reserves. And they then go to the legislature every time that there's a dip and say, we need money. And so that is a possibility. So that what the 16.7 represents is something lower than what Commerce would require fully insured markets, or what they would advise on smaller groups, but appropriate enough for our size and given the kinds of historical fluctuations that we've experienced.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all the attention that's going around local or nationally right now with the Obamacare and whatnot, just recently we've got 36 new members that came into our, you know, with the House, for example, and quite a few in the Senate. And then, but generally, just all members, are any of us ever denied coverage for pre-existing conditions, whether it be diabetes or heart disease or cancer or asthma, or is anybody denied coverage, or perhaps our family members? Or I'm just kind of curious how that's handled for the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Morocco?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the state does not have any pre-existing clauses in its program, so we simply take employees and their dependents as is as they come into the program. We do follow state mandates, which is a little bit unique for a self-insured group. That means as the legislature creates state mandates on health plans, which would typically only affect fully insured products, we do follow all those state mandates as well. So if the legislature has deemed that certain things should be covered, we will automatically cover those things. But there are no pre-existing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Morocco. I'm just curious. I've never been in an organization with a self-insured plan. Are there analysis about, you know, whether it makes sense for us to do this compared to other private means of accomplishing insurance for employees? And is that? I'd just be curious if you'd walk me through maybe the argument about that.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if I understand the question correctly, it's the decision about whether to go fully insured or self-insured. Is that correct? So, well, certainly for self-insured groups, there's typically a lot of dollars to be saved. First of all, you're not paying a health plan to underwrite your risk. So if they are going to take on your risk, which is what they do in a fully insured market, you know, they're going to want some spread and some cushion on that. So to the extent that you're no longer, requiring a third entity to take on that risk, there's going to be some savings. There can be savings on the tax side as well, depending on what tax you're looking at. Some taxes only apply to the fully insured market. So groups that do go self-insured, and I think what the state has observed is that over time, over the last 10 years, there has been more of a movement for private employers to go self-insured to avoid some of those taxes. There can be some cost savings there. For an organization of our size, it would be really highly unlikely to be fully insured. I'm not aware of any organization, whether it be 3M, Target, Medtronic, Wells Fargo, I mean, anybody that would be in our size, which is considered a jumbo size to the health plans, I'm not aware of any that are actually fully insured. There's too many benefits to be gained, and you have a lot more control over the program when you're self-insured.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I like the idea of self-insurance, but you walked us through this spreadsheet here, which I think everyone now is kind of interested in. And one of the things that I heard in this was the connection between your decision about contingency reserves and the level of premiums that are being increased. And we talk about there being basically three, a risk sharing that's going on here. So I want to be sure I've understood that correctly so I can explain this to my constituents. It seems to me that the decision to move the contingency reserve down to a two-month level of reserve, as you've described it, is a decision in essence to have some more risk shifted back to the legislature. You described a situation where some folks have zero reserve, in which case the legislature's basic and the people, the taxpayers, paying, basically bearing all of the risk. We have a cushion here of 2 months, which sounds like you talked to actuaries and said that seems okay. I'm not sure I can explain why that seems okay. Should it be 2 months, 3 months, 4 months? How do you arrive at that number? Because it feels a bit plucked out of the air to me, but I'm not an actuarial science. I don't know. Could you explain that to me, please?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a very good question. I can answer it at a very high level because I'm not the Department of Commerce who regulates. But certainly there are going to be risk continuance tables that are created for any group that's willing to that wants to underwrite itself. And to the extent, just as you may do in your 401k investing, just as some people might be willing to take a lot of risk for a potential lot of gain, and others might want little risk for little gain, within a contingency reserve, you have that same philosophy. So the Department of Commerce would say, well, how much risk are we willing to allow a group to take on in order to sort of sign off on that policy? So as best I can tell you is that, again, the fully insured market, as a result of analysis by the Department of Commerce, tends to be underwritten at about 30 to 35% of reserves. And for a group our size, in conversations with both our actuaries, which is a third-party administrator, actuarial firm, Deloitte Consulting, and working with the regulators of Commerce and Health, that the 2 months seem to strike the right balance between managing the risk and not really holding on to more money than we really need.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Morocco, I'm going to push just a little bit on that particular last statement, because it seems to me we've entered a period with the passage of the health care reform. Whether one likes it or doesn't like it, it does increase the amount of uncertainty, at least that some of us feel, about cost containment that's going on. I know it's aimed at cost containment, but there's a lot of moving parts in this. It strikes me as unusual and sort of a, I don't know, I don't get the idea of increasing the exposure of the state to the risk of self-insuring at a time when we have increased uncertainty about what cost containment is going to look like going down the road. I'm not sure there's even a question there if you got a reaction to that or not, but I just want to be able to say that.
Thank you.
Mr. Morocco, did you wish to respond to that?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't.
Okay. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is sort of labor relations related in terms of, I look across the line in the premium increase, and that's a sizable jump. And my experience, at least, is, you know, we negotiate contracts every couple of years. What have you done for me lately? If I look at those out years and I look at, from a negotiating standpoint, a 17% increase, might there be some pressure on negotiations to say, you know, we need to change the formula, we need to do better, we're taking a sizable chunk out of take-home pay, that kind of thing. Wouldn't it be better to manage, I mean, and this goes to risk, but wouldn't it be better to manage out those highs? 17% from zero, a couple of zeros in a row is a lot of change.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would absolutely agree with you. It certainly would be more preferential to have more consistent, sort of even-keeled kinds of premiums from year to year. I think that helps agencies budget better as well. However, the reason that I have put the program in this form is that I'm not comfortable hanging on to money that the program shouldn't have. And the only way that I can move that money back out to the agencies that have funded that program is through premiums. And so it does create some volatility, and I would say that as a program, you know, we're not really happy about the 17%. But the only way for me to manage that differently is to hold back on some of the reserves and perhaps spread it out over a couple years, say 2 to 3 years. I think that would be much more advantageous perhaps for the agencies or for policymakers and really for the budget folks to manage better. But again, in order for me to do that, that means that I'm holding on to money across years when I really shouldn't have, I really don't need it in the program. And so I feel ultimately it's more responsible to give that money back to the folks that have contributed to it as quickly as I can so that, so that I'm not carrying those monies over that I shouldn't need. But certainly it's always our goal that we set premiums equal to be roughly medical trend. So if we're expecting an 8% increase in medical trend, we're going to set the premiums at roughly 8%. And it's really in this unusual situation where we really had a phenomenally great year in 2008 is really what led to this large increase. The challenge that we have is that when we enter the bargaining process and the budget setting process, we're really talking about a roughly 5 to 6 year span of time. I'm typically looking at 2 years in the past, because that's usually my full complete year is 2 years in the past, trying to project out where the program might be in 3 to 4 to 5 years, both for bargaining and for budgeting purposes. So with the spread of 5 years and the kind of volatility that occurs in the medical industry, where in the last 10 years we've had anywhere between, not just us, but nationally, we've had increases anywhere between 3% to 15% in any given year. That's the kind of volatility then that we're trying to match up over a 5 year span of time to try to figure out where is really healthcare going. So the challenge is for every point that we're off in the program on that in the base year, roughly amounts to the program is $600 million, so a percent is going to be about $6 million. So when you compound that over 4 to 5 years, that $6 million single error compounds into roughly $50 million. So the numbers can add up very quickly, which is why, again, I like to react very quickly on the reserve side. If we're below that 16.7, we're going to react very quickly and increase premiums. And if we're above that 16.7, again, we're going to react as quickly as we can and move the premiums down.
Ms. Plant, we've got some more questions here, but obviously we're not going to have time today to talk about this workforce report, which is an important report for us to go over. Would it be possible for you and anyone else who will be speaking to us about this to be rescheduled?
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Okay. We will try to work that out. Our administrator will be in touch with you to figure out a timing as to when we can have you back for that piece of it. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I guess, forgive me if you've explained this and I didn't pick up on it, but the 16.7% reserve number that you were discussing with Representative Banyan, How long has have you used that as a standard? What's the, I guess, the history? We've got a little bit of history here, which shows it going down pretty quickly, as I presume market conditions have driven it down. But how long have you fixed that 16.7% number as your target? You know, absent market conditions changing, would you still be up in the mid-30s?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that reserve level has been the policy since about 2004 on the program. We went self-insured in 2002, so we didn't necessarily have a reserve policy in the first couple of years, because going the fully self-insured, frankly, we were really targeting where we used to be, which was more around the 30 to 35%. So that was the mindset at the time that the program was created. However, after a couple of years worth of experience and having a better handle on the costs of the program and that we had all the right cost controls in place, then we were certainly more comfortable then in bringing down into what was, I think, the more appropriate 16.7. So it's been roughly 7 years that we've had that policy.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Winkler.
But the real move down, I guess, didn't take place until the market drove you down. Was there a reason why you didn't, spend that reserve down in premium, not reductions, I suppose, but limits on growth earlier?
Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, actually the current reserve that you're seeing is really a phenomenon just of the last couple of years. In prior years, if we were to look going back to 2003, you would see reserve levels in those prior years even in the 20 to 25% range. We've used different techniques at various times. In 1 year in 2006, in December of 2006, when we were over reserved, we had a premium holiday for all agencies. So essentially, we didn't collect any premiums for that month. It was a pay period holiday. So that we were over reserved by $20 million. We wanted to get that money back to the agencies that had contributed to the over reserve, and so we did a one-time premium holiday as a way to do that. So there has been other techniques used in the past. The reserves have been lower in the past. What you're seeing today on that 35% is a result of a miscalculation in the bargaining from 2009. Did that answer your question, Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think so. I guess the takeaway I'm taking from this is that you've always had this goal of 16.7%, but things happen and it fluctuates significantly. But you're, as a floor, you've got this 16.7 number. And as the percentage rises over time, you may introduce various measures to bring it down, but it's not like you're so concerned about managing closely to the 16.7% as long as it's at least that.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question ties in a little bit with Representative Winkler's there. How are these reserves invested, and are they affected so much by market conditions, or are they more affected by claims against the reserves?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand the second part. To the first part, we invest through the State Board of Investment, so we're using the expertise that already exists here at the state to manage the investment of the reserves. Can you repeat this, the second component?
I was just wondering what effect claims had on the reserve balance, if that had an effect also along with market conditions.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so reserves are 16.7% of expected claims. If claims come in higher for a year, then that has the effect of lowering our reserve as a percentage. To the extent that claims come in lower, that will have the impact of raising the reserve higher than what we're expecting. I'm not sure if that answers your question. So reserves are always a condition of anticipated claims. Okay. So when we start the year, we expect that the program is going to cost $600 million. Then we want our reserve to be 16.7% of that $600 million. To the extent that at the end of the year the program didn't spend $600 million, perhaps it spent less, then in essence that becomes some carry forward value to the next year's reserve. And to the extent that perhaps we experience more than the $600 million, then that puts more burden on the future year's reserve, and that might be a situation where we then increase premiums as a way to get the reserves back up to the 16.7 of expected claims for the next year.
Well, Mr. Morocco and Ms. Plant, thank you very much. We're out of time for today, and we will be in touch with you about rescheduling the report. Members, please put this report in your save folder so that we will have it. And tomorrow we're going to be focused on the service innovation report that we've been waiting to have before us, so we'll have a panel presentation on that tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.